Okay, thank you, Brigitte. When we were doing the meditation on mindfulness of breathing, I was thinking of a conversation that I had with a friend who is a Dharma teacher. She's a meditation teacher, and she mostly teaches on, even before all of this stuff happened, she mostly teaches online. She doesn't drive that much anymore, and I think there's a way that she prefers the one-on-one meeting. So she does a lot of kind of Skype or video chat or something, Zoom, something like this. And she has a student who is in the UK, a man who I think is in his 70s, and he did get sick. This student, he did get sick with COVID-19. About a month ago, and he didn't have to be hospitalized, but he was pretty sick, and fevers and really labored breathing, and one of the things that he reported to her was that he found that the practice of mindfulness was tremendously helpful in that he became very fascinated, very curious in attending to the sensations of breathing. And as his breathing became with more shortness of breath and more labored breathing, he was able to, I think part of the physiological response, I don't know that much about this, but I think part of the physiological response is when our lungs aren't working that well, we tend to breathe faster to try to get more air in, just natural response, which tends to be not that helpful because it kind of sets a cycle going. But he found that there was a way through just being very aware and very present and very calm, he could just stay with those sensations of breathing and not let a sort of reactive mind and the fear, which of course was there, and all these other things, not let that take over. And he found whenever he could do that, his breath became easier again, and it became fuller again. And he's kind of like riding these waves, and he wrote it out. He just, he was lucky, but he credited the practice with not only, of course, helping him stay somewhat calm and balanced, but he thinks that it supported his body, supported his breath anyway. It was just something that came up for me when we were just talking about practicing with the breath. So I had the idea tonight to share a few words about a Buddhist term, a Dharma term that is pretty important, is pretty central to the practice of meditation. And the Pali word is Nirodha. Some of you might have heard of this term, Nirodha. It's often translated as cessation. If you're familiar with the Four Noble Truths, there's the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, of dukkha. And then there's the cause of suffering, the origin of suffering, which is a clinging, a tanha. And then the third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering, and that's nirodha. And then there's the fourth noble truth, the path to the cessation of suffering, at the end of suffering. So nirodha is sometimes translated as cessation, But that sounds a little bit, I don't know, to me it sounds a little clinical or legalistic or something. According to Gill, who, you know, understands a lot about Pali, and he says that if you look at the etymology of the word nirodha, rodha is obstruction, and ni is like, you know, no or not. So it's like this state of not being obstructed, of having no obstructions, unobstructedness. Early in my meditation practice, I was staying at Tassajara. Some of you might know Tassajara, the Zen mountain center in Carmel Valley, and was visiting in the cabin of a friend who was living there. And he had a picture of himself and his teacher, his Zen teacher, and they were both very involved with San Quentin, the prison, the San Quentin, and there was there still is a long-running meditation sangha there. And I don't know why I remember this, but it was a framed photo of my friend and his teacher, and San Quentin was in the background, but they were sort of at the entrance to San Quentin, and there was a big stop sign there. And they were both standing kind of proudly next to the stop sign. And I didn't know that much about Buddhism or meditation or Dharma. But when I learned about this idea of cessation, of stopping, then I said, oh, that's why they look so pleased to be standing next to this big stop sign. And so there's something about stopping, about pausing, that is considered very important, very central to Dharma practice. And one of the ways I think about it is to stop, to pause, to be is in a way the beginning of practice. It's sort of the nature of our practice is that we stop and we look and we listen. This willingness to press pause on our, you know, usual conditioned leaning forward into experience and reaching and wanting and grasping. So that's kind of the essence of the Dharma, right? Is to stop. This capacity that we all have to stop, just as we just did for this meditation period. You know, we made the intention to be here and open to the experience of this moment. And so that's a kind of stopping. So we could say that stopping or pausing is the essence of the practice. It's the beginning of the practice. I think there's so much that we miss when we just move through the world with a lot of speed and not a lot of awareness. Some of you might have heard this, but I've heard that at one of our esteemed local small businesses called Facebook, that one of the mottos at Facebook is move fast and break things. And they live up to their motto. But, you know, this idea of like to be successful in the world, you got to move fast, grab the bull by the horns, take advantage of opportunities. And yeah, you know, we'll break a few eggs to make that omelet. But And maybe there's some truth to that, and there's a time and a place for that. But it's interesting that what we can see, what we can learn when we slow down, what we can learn when we stop. And, so in a way, stopping is the essence of the practice. It's the beginning of the practice. And then if you think about the Four Noble Truths, the suggestion there is that a certain kind of stopping, a certain kind of cessation is also the goal of the practice, or the end of the practice, or the promise of the practice. You know, the Third Noble Truth is the end of suffering, is that, the waking up. And it's interesting that that would be described, waking up would be described as cessation. So what kind of cessation, what kind of ending, what kind of stilling, of stopping could be freeing? I think often, certainly for me, I don't like endings that much. I don't like saying goodbye. I don't like, kind of just my conditioning is that you're going to lose something wonderful. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes that's certainly true about endings. And I think it's a little bit of a challenge to us in our conventional ways of thinking to think what kind of ending brings peace? What kind of ending brings freedom? And so maybe we could say the ending of agitation brings calm. The ending of confusion brings clarity. The ending of delusion brings wisdom. And so maybe there's a way that practice is asking us to sit still and make space and open up to our suffering, our pain, our confusion, our unease, our agitation, which usually the last thing we want to do is be with that. We want to run as fast as we can away from it, or distract ourselves. One of the things I noticed during our whole shelter in place is I had this craving to just watch. We don't really have TV that much here, but we have like Netflix and that we watch on the computer sometimes. And at night, I would just have this craving to watch something, some comedy or something, and just kind of check out a little bit. I just didn't want to, I wanted to laugh. I wanted to watch something silly, And this kind of, it was just interesting to me because although I always enjoy something silly, I've noticed that impulse to kind of escape just, was much more present, with just the stress of everything that was going on. So the last thing, we want to do is sit still with our suffering. But this idea that through practice, we develop this capacity to be with what's difficult, to hold all of that, to stay with it. And in that staying, in that willingness to be present, there's a kind of transformation that when we're not fueling it anymore, when we're not resisting it, we're not struggling with it, right? That's the second noble truth. The cause of suffering, the cause of our extra unnecessary suffering is our struggle, is our resistance, is our denial, is our grasping. So the more we can be with things as they are, without grasping, without pushing them away. And then we begin to open to the fact that this dukkha, this difficulty, has an end. And usually I think we're so on to the next thing, we don't stick around for the ending. You know, we're on to my next problem, my next thing. So this invitation to stop. And when we stop, we can become aware that experience is stopping all the time, is ending all the time. It's beginning and it's ending. It's beginning and it's ending. This is impermanence, right? This is change. The more we open to the changing nature of experience, the more we can see that there are these beginnings and endings happening all the time. And the suggestion in almost all of these maps of meditation, you know, there's all this various kinds of maps of you notice this and this will happen, and then you notice this and this will happen. And almost invariably, this encounter with change, this willingness to be present for the way things come and go, the way things change, brings calm, brings equanimity. You know, and we might think that the last thing I want to be present for is how things change, because that means that they're unstable, that they're uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen next. And what brings ease is safety and certainty. And why would I want to open to what's changing and what's uncertain? So it's a little bit counterintuitive, perhaps, but the suggestion, the invitation is that the more we can be with change, with impermanence, with the inconstancy of experience, this brings equanimity. This actually balances the mind, calms the mind, eases the mind. This is very interesting. And my own interpretation of why this might be, and you can see if this is true for you, or if this rings true for you, is that our being longs to be in touch, longs to make contact with what is true. You know, to be with what's true, to be with truth, to be with what's real. And what could be more real than change, than impermanence? Our bodies are changing, our minds are changing, sounds and thoughts and feelings and other people and the weather, everything's changing. And so when we kind of separate ourselves from this, it might be a good coping strategy sometimes. You know, I like to watch something on TV or you know, I think there's a time and a place for that. But there's a way that our being longs to open to what's true. And when we have that sustained contact, like my friend was talking about with her student who was sick, you know, when you're really sick in bed and you've got something and it's hard to breathe, that's what's true in this moment. You know, and he didn't want to check out. He didn't want to just, you know, be drugged into oblivion. He wanted to really be there and really feel, what is this? What's happening? And by being able to make that kind of contact with what was true, his system could relax. You know, there wasn't a struggle anymore. All that energy that we usually use to protect ourselves and try to make things just the way we want them to be, he didn't need to use that energy. So that could all be released. So this idea that opening to what's true, opening to the way things changes, brings calm and brings equanimity. And from this place of equanimity, we're able to open to the way experience begins and ends. And so this is also a kind of cessation to see the end of a thought, the end of a sensation. Like if you've ever had the experience of meditating, and you know, often it's meditating with a group, and there's, you have a certain itch, you know, an itch on the face or something. And, you know, normally if we have an itch, we just scratch it. We don't think about it. We're not really aware. And nothing wrong with that, really. But when we're meditating, we're, you know, if we're lucky, in that moment of the itch, we realize, oh, there's an itch that's happening. And we realize that we have a choice. If we're blessed, you know, if we're graced by a moment or two of mindfulness, and we realize, wow, my ear, there's an itch in my ear. And normally I would just reach up and scratch it, and I kind of want to scratch it, or I really do want to scratch it. But what if I just don't move and just stay here and feel that itch, open to it? You know, it's not going to hurt me. I'm not going to die of this itch. It's a little unpleasant, but what if I just let it be and just meet it, touch it with awareness? And what we might discover is that there's no solid thing called my itch or my knee pain or whatever it is, but it's actually sensations, vibrations, contact, pressure that's moving and changing, that's increasing in intensity maybe, and then decreasing in intensity. And then at a certain point, it ends. It always ends. It always changes into something else. And then it ends. And that can be an enlightening moment. That can be a freeing moment. I say, wow, I don't have to react to every single nudge and itch. And I don't have to react every time. Maybe that also means I don't have to react every time someone says something that irritates me a little bit. I don't have to react every time my children or my partner or a thing or some politician says something or does something. I might feel it. I might feel something. But I have a new kind of freedom. Sometimes, of course, I will scratch that itch. Sometimes it's wise to act, to say something, to, you know, if we notice that we're meditating and our body is not sitting, you know, is sitting in a way that's not good for us. Yes, change the posture, move, stretch. But there are also times where we kind of want to move just because we want a little bit of entertainment or a little bit of, you know, we're fidgeting, we're squirming. And then we notice, wait a second, I don't have to move. I don't have to scratch that itch. If I wait and I'm patient, it's going to end. It's going to change to something else. And so this is the freedom of, you know, this is one of the kinds of freedom of endings, of cessation. And the more we explore this, and the more we value the possibility of stopping, of being present, of patience. Then we begin to open to a cessation as a noble truth, you know, as a way of touching into what sometimes said is what is most beautiful, most brilliant about our minds. Usually we think that, you know, a beautiful mind is a mind that thinks beautiful thoughts or thinks interesting thoughts or has wholesome, loving emotions. And, you know, which is true, which is all true. It's very beautiful. But there's a kind of radical invitation, which I think is there in these Four Noble Truths. And it's saying that as beautiful as the most beautiful thoughts or feelings or emotions that a human mind can have, the kind of ultimate beauty or the ultimate happiness comes from stilling the mind, stilling the activity of the mind. That when that mind is brought to cessation, that it opens another dimension of our being, which we usually miss because we're leaning into the next thought. It's like we're kind of like, I imagine, like swinging from vine to vine, you know, so we're going to catch the next thought and then the next thought and then the next thought. And, you know, we don't notice the space between thoughts. We don't notice the gap. That's why I love this line, which is from Suzuki Roshi, which I said in the meditation, that at the very end of the out-breath, at the very end of the exhalation, is the perfect calmness of mind. You know, in this space between the ending of one breath and the beginning of the next breath. You know, and that's, how close is that? I mean, this happening all the time. So some teachers, some practitioners describe this a little bit like the analogy is like the space that's in a room. Usually, we're oriented towards the objects in the room. You know, this room has a bookshelf and a desk and a chair and a computer. And we don't really notice the space in the room. We don't notice the empty space, you know, because it's really nothing. Actually, there's nothing special about it. It's just the absence. You know, if our whole room was filled with stuff, and I have been in rooms like that, it's actually not that pleasant. So, one of my best friends growing up, his father is a book collector. Many of us are book collectors, but he was a really big time used book collector. And his dream was to open a used bookshop, but over the, you know, I grew up with my friend, right? So I knew him for 15 years or 18 years. And little by little, their house filled more and more with stacks of books everywhere. And they're kind of interesting books and good books. And but at a certain point, it's like, you can't really breathe. You can't really, you know, so we don't notice, sometimes we don't value the space. We don't notice the space until there's so little of it. And, you know, and then we say, wow. Or we might not appreciate space until we go into a different kind of home or a different kind of room. Sometimes for some of us, it's going into a church or a meditation hall or a temple or something. And wow, you know, these cathedrals, like the European cathedrals, they know about space. It's like, you know, the scale of like a human being is like here, and then the building is like here. There's all this space. Or I remember the first time I went into a Zendo, you know, a Japanese meditation room, meditation hall. And there was something that it was so simple. The way the cushions were lined up, just a wooden floor, white walls, black cushions. And even though the room was not that, you know, it didn't measure that big, it felt so spacious. You know, there's room, there's so much room there. So, you know, it might be an encounter with someone, a person who, you know, there's just something about their presence, their mind, that just feels spacious. Feels like they're open, they're accepting, they don't want anything from us, they're not, you know, fighting to get the next word in. They're just spacious, they're just there. And we have a sense of this absence, this wonderful absence. So cessation is sometimes understood in that way, this wonderful absence. In a way, this is a little bit of a long introduction to what I wanted to read, which is very short, which comes from a book that I've brought to San Jose before, and this is called 33 Fingers. Some of you may know the expression of that talking about the Dharma is like a finger pointing at the moon. You know, but the moon is reality. The moon is awakening. And the finger is just the pointer, right? It's just the words. So this is 33 fingers, 33 chapters. And actually he has a revised and expanded edition, which is called 49 fingers. But this, and so these are little, this is called 33 fingers, a collection of modern American koans by Michael Wenger. Some of you know Michael Wenger from San Francisco Zen Center. And a koan is, you know, it's a story. It's a story about practice that is meant to awaken something inside of us. It's not so much like we need to figure it out intellectually, but it's like, it's a story. It's more like a suggestion. And the idea is to let that suggestion just live in us. You know, that we don't have to really even understand it, but some part of our being may take it in and take it up. And so this is case number 12, finger number 12. What is nirvana? Sojourn Mel Weitzman asked Suzuki Roshi, what is nirvana? Suzuki replied, seeing one thing through to the end. And that's the case. What is nirvana? Suzuki replied, seeing one thing through to the end. And I, early in my practice, when I first heard this, I thought, that's kind of an interesting, you know, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but, you know, the classical answer, if you look it up in a book, this question, what is nirvana? It might say, nirvana is the end of suffering, right? Nirvana is the end, or it might say that nirvana is the end of greed, hatred, and delusion, something like that. You know, that would be a classical Dharma answer. And so it's interesting that Suzuki Roshi says, Nirvana is seeing one thing through to the end. And what I love about this, for me, I feel like this is pointing to the immediacy of our own experience, that change is happening all the time, endings are happening all the time. It's all cessation, nirvana, is as close to us as the end of this thought, the end of this breath, the end of this sound. And so it's what I love about it is it's so ordinary, it's so close. And then the other thing I like is to see something through to the end. It implies a kind of commitment or a kind of dedication, right? You know, to hang in there. Usually we don't want to wait around for the end. We're too busy. We're going to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So that there's a value in staying with this, that staying with this itch, whatever the itch is, whatever form the itch is taking, to stay with this itch and see its true nature. See that it is something that arises, it changes, and then it ends. And usually we wouldn't think, why would I ever want to do that? And this is saying, well, this is the most, you know, nirvana is like the ultimate lofty thing, right? So this is maybe the most valuable thing, is to see the way things end. So in these traditional koan stories, there's a commentary. So I'll read you Michael's commentary. Nirvana is a Sanskrit term usually translated as extinction, oblivion, or bliss. It is a release from the conditioned. How to be free? See each thing through to the end. Don't move. You know, in Zen, there's this emphasis on being very still in meditation. And while in Vipassana, in mindfulness practice, we don't talk so much about physical stillness. One of the interesting explorations is to just see what supports stillness of the body and what supports stillness of the mind. Because this is pointing to stilling the mind. And I think that it also points to to get close to this stillness. It's almost like we need to let go of even of any kind of doing. You know, sometimes in meditation we can get very busy. Okay, I'm going to be with the breath, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do concentration, and then I have to do this and that. You know, so I have a personality of kind of a doer, so I want to do things. And I think that can be very skillful in meditation, but it might be that this is pointing to discovering a place of non-doing. And once there's, you know, a certain amount of mindfulness and a certain amount of calm and ease, just to see if we can open up to not doing anything, just being, just leaving everything as it is. You know, and it takes a lot of trust to do that, a lot of patience. Because sometimes if we leave everything as it is, what comes up is our pain. What comes up is our suffering. What comes up is, oh, wow, I'm pretty scared right now, or pretty uncomfortable, or, you know, whatever it is. So it takes a lot of courage, in a way, to be with our minds as it is, as they are. But I, maybe this is a doorway into the kind of non-doing that opens us to cessation, opens us to this radical stilling of the mind.